You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump has cut aid to three Central American countries and threatened to close the U.S. border with Mexico. We'll talk about the possible impact of those moves and what impact they could have on immigration. First, when then-candidate Donald Trump announced he was running for president 4 years ago, he talked about a vision of America that was kind of bleak.
Sadly, the American dream is dead. But if I get elected president, I will bring it back bigger and better and stronger than ever before.
For a lot of Americans, that vision was exactly right, reflecting some of the huge economic and cultural shifts they'd witnessed in their own towns and cities. In his new book, our next guest took a closer look at what's driving that divide and says it's about more than just low wages and jobs going overseas. Tim Carney is the commentary editor for the Washington Examiner and a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He's the author of multiple books. His latest is called Alienated America, Why Some Places Thrive While Others Collapse. Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
What set you out on this journey, and you were literally journeying, to find out why some communities did well, others did poorly?
Well, it was a lot of it was Donald Trump. Seeing him proclaim the American dream was dead and seeing that message resonate so widely and, you know, him rocket to the top of the Republican primary polls right away in mid-2015, it made it clear to me that, you know, we needed a better explanation of why this view held so widely while so many broader indicators, stock market, unemployment, those sort of things were improving. A lot of people had explanations, and I went out to find what I thought was, I went out to find my own explanation in part because I figured it had to be a local question. It couldn't be something just nationwide. There were places where the American dream was alive and well and places where it seemed dead. And that's what I was trying to figure out in Alienated America.
And the obvious answer would seem to be it's economics. It's places that have lost factories, that have had economic hardship. You say that's only part of the story. You saw something deeper. What did you start to find?
That's right. Often the closing factory is a first domino, but it's not the whole story, and you're skipping a step if you stop there. The cover of the book is a shuttered church, not a shuttered factory. And that's because what distinguish the places that have good outcomes and where Donald Trump didn't have resonance in the early Republican primaries from the places with bad outcomes and where people came out of the woodwork to support Trump, people who had never been involved in elections, standing in line, going to caucuses in Iowa. What distinguished those two classes of places wasn't really income. It wasn't really exposure to competition with China. It wasn't those factors. It was the strength of community institutions. And here we're talking about bowling leagues. We're talking about public schools. But most importantly, for the middle class in middle America, civil society community has meant church. And where that has collapsed, that's where you saw the worst outcomes. And that's frankly where you saw the strongest support for Donald Trump in those early Republican primaries.
Tim, we're in Wisconsin, so I want to detour to one of the communities you focus on in your book, Oostburg, Wisconsin. Tell us the story of that community and how it fits into what you're talking about.
So I ended up in Oostburg because of what I had noticed in Iowa. Donald Trump's two worst counties in Iowa were Sioux County and Lyon County, and he also did really poorly in Marion County. These are the counties with the highest Dutch population. I'm an Irish Catholic from New York, so where I came from, white people were either Irish or Italian. So this idea of Dutch ethnicity really appealed to me, and it was interesting. And then in western Michigan, which I'm in Grand Rapids, about to speak at Calvin College, and here Donald Trump did really poorly in western Michigan. Now, one thing about these are very, I'm talking about the primaries here, but these are very conservative, very Christian places, these Dutch towns, Dutch counties in Michigan and Iowa. So I picked the most Dutch place in Wisconsin ahead of the Wisconsin primaries, and that was the village of Oostburg, about 2,000 people in Sheboygan County. And sure enough, Oostburg, which has been called by some political pundits the most conservative place in Wisconsin, Donald Trump bombed in the Republican primaries. There, Ted Cruz cleaned up, and Trump got a lowly 15 or 16%. So what was it about the Dutch that were rejecting Trump? And the answer, I argue, throughout Alienated America is that the community is really strong in these various places, Western Michigan, Sioux County, Oostburg, these Dutch places. It's not their ethnicity so much. It's that they have these really strong Christian Reformed churches that build a strong sense of duty to one's neighbor, strong sense of social trust. So the American dream is alive and well in these places. And while a lot of rural America, it's not so strong. And that was Trump's appeal early on.
Talking to Tim Carney about his new book, Alienated America, Why Some Places Thrive While Others Collapse. Tim, talk about that wider idea of civil society, that third place between our work and our home. Why has it been disappearing? Not just the church, as you say, but in a lot of other ways, too.
That's right. And so Robert Putnam, you'll remember, wrote Bowling Alone 20 years ago, charting this decline. And it's been declining for everybody, and it's been declining more among the working class. And that's one of the key points that I'm trying to drive home here, that a lot of the shape of modernity is towards both centralization and hyper-individualism. Now, these sound like opposites, but I argue they're the same, different sides of the same coin. And that's what Alexis de Tocqueville argued in Democracy in America 200 years ago. Centralization of our attention and of government have led to an erosion of things on the local level, whether it's local government, a local school board, a local parish, a swim club, the Knights of Columbus, those sorts of institutions. People have pulled away from them, and technology is a huge factor in this. Just our televisions, our homes, our air conditioning, our iPhones, our social media draws people away. Those are our two major factors, and again, you see sort of the hyper-individualism, people wanting to... Fewer people, especially young people, want to belong to something, because belonging to something can seem like a sacrifice of your own self-determination. Oh, well, I'm going to show up when I want to show up and not show up when I don't feel like it. And that's not the same as belonging to a thing, whether it be a church or a club or a PTA. Those are things that you wed yourself to, and they're sticky, and you can't necessarily extract yourself immediately and neatly. And I think a lot of the modern mindset is towards extracting yourself, and especially among the middle class and the working class, one of the results is this alienation and a lot of bad life outcomes, whether it's dropping out of high school, teenage pregnancy, getting on disability, getting on drugs. All of those things are correlated with alienation and with the erosion of these institutions.
You write some about, and a lot of people have been talking about this, have and have-not communities. We have some cities and regions and counties doing really well economically. And one problem you see is that to the extent we have geographic mobility in the country, it might be people moving from the have-not areas to the have areas and taking a big talent pool with them, the people who might have been the leader in the PTA, say.
That's exactly right. And so this is... one of the things that I talked about, the first domino of the factory closing. Factory closes in a small Midwestern town. What happens? The parents who are most assertive, most acute, aware of what's going on, are the first ones to get up and move to someplace else where there's more promise. So what happens to the people left behind? Now they just lost their PTA dad and their girls' basketball coach, and that this is what's happening in towns around the country. So we have less geographic segregation by race in America than we did 50 years ago. We have more geographic segregation by education level and by income. And so one of the things that happens is the smaller towns are left with less skill, with less ambition, as a lot of people are getting up and moving out. And so then you see how the dominoes start to fall. In the places that maybe have one church and one coffee shop and one bowling alley, those things can pretty quickly, if one of them shuts down, people have less of an ability to connect with their neighbors. They have less of a safety net. And if you're tightly knit in these things, you know that when you were sick, the people who brought you family, who brought you meals, they were from your work, from your church, from your local pub. They were from these institutions. If you're not as connected to those institutions, it's easier for your life to fall apart, and it's easier for these towns to crumble. And that's why I talk about the domino theory. Is a lot of times when something starts to go wrong this day and age, you see the most active, aggressive, skilled people get up and go somewhere else, and they're all congregating in a few big cities, and a lot of rural America is left without people who are going to run these local institutions.
We're talking to Tim Carney from the Washington Examiner about his new book, Alienated America, Why Some Places Thrive While Others Collapse. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does this sound like your community? Have you seen the churches close, the local groups, the PTA start to collapse, the local stores? Or are you living in a town or city that's growing? What do you think makes the difference? Do you feel that sense of community in your town where you have the people who will bring you food when somebody's sick in your family, or where you do that for them? What drives you to do that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now about what's driving the decline of some communities and the growth and prospering of others. Tim Carney is with us. His new book is Alienated America, Why Some Places Thrive While Others Collapse. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What changes have you seen in the community you live in over the years? Have they been for the better, for the worse? Does it feel like a community? Do you feel connected to the people in the town, village, city, neighborhood that you live in? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hello.
Hi. I'm an immigrant to this country from the Netherlands. I immigrated with my family from, we moved to Holland, Michigan. So I'm really familiar with Western Michigan and Grand Rapids and Calvin College and all that, the Christian Reformed Church and its influence on that community. I would say that the rejection of Donald Trump's or at least to not swallow as much of it, is partly due to just the nature of Dutch culture. The people in the Netherlands are much more practical and not so susceptible to his con, I guess. And, they're really practical in their solutions, the Netherlands itself. And the difference between the Netherlands and Western Michigan is that I found that the whole culture of the Christian Reformed Church was much more judgmental than the nature of Dutch society today.
Well, thanks a lot for the call. Well, you were talking about the Dutch influence in the communities you were looking at, Tim. There's some firsthand example. What do you think of what Willem had to say?
I think it's a lot of times it's hard to separate judgmental and tight-knit, and that's one of the problems I talk about in Alienated America. And I do talk about how one of the great ways America handles some of the problems that can come with very close, sometimes insular societies, is that we have so many overlapping layers of society. So if you're living in Holland, Michigan, there's a local government, there's a public school system, there's a Christian school system, there's a church, and you can belong to many of them at the same time. You can, and then there's a civil society that can be run through with the Dutch ethnicity, but also just with sort of Michigan local pride and that sort of thing. And so we have so many different layers. One of the things Alexis Tocqueville said is he was just sort of amazed that Americans seem to be constantly forming little associations of all sorts, and that people would belong to so many of them. So you're not just a member of kind of the church and that sort of thing. So if you're a sociologist and you look at the numbers, the Mormons and the Dutch Reform, both of which can have a reputation of being judgmental or exclusive, they've got great outcomes as far as their children finishing school, getting married, being less likely to have children out of wedlock, less likely to get into drugs. So how to balance the virtues of those tight-knit communities against the potential threats is always a problem. But right now in America, the problem is not that people are too closely knit and tightly wound with their neighbors. The problem is the opposite.
Willem, thanks for the call. Going out to Mike on the line in Lake Mills. Mike, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, and this is an important subject. I like the idea of a community. As a matter of fact, I believe it was Hillary Clinton says it takes a...
But we're losing Mike's line. Mike wanted to bring up... there you are.
We're talking about a church, and we're talking about Christian churches. American communities are not Christian churches. They're buildings of faith, whether it's the Christian faith, whether it's the Islam faith, whether it's the Jewish faith.
I gotcha, Mike, and thanks for that call. And Tim, actually, that takes us back to Oostburg. You address some of what Mike's talking about later in the book.
Well, so I'm glad he said it takes a village. I'm sorry that the audio was cutting out on that. But It Takes a Village is the title of chapter one of my book, because Hillary Clinton wrote a book with that title, and a lot of conservatives sort of ganged up on it because they thought she meant something like it takes big government to raise your kids and that sort of thing. But my argument is, and my wife and I, we have six kids. We do not think we do this alone. We know that it takes neighbors, it takes community, it takes schools, it takes all of that stuff to get through this and raising a kid. But the other point is, America is a very ecumenical country. And so in Oostburg, there again was both this problem that can come with things that can be insular and the solution of the multiple levels of government, which was when someone wanted to set up the Islamic Center of Sheboygan County. There were members who opposed it because it was unchristian, because they had fears of terrorism, and even one of the clergy at one of the Reformed churches there had an opposition to it. And then in the end, though, it was up to the civil government to say yes or no. And they said, look, this doesn't violate any of the laws. And even if some of the people there thought, well, we're Christian, this is a Christian town, and in a way that that they thought somehow the nature of their town would be changed by one Islamic center, which was wrong-headed. But even if they had that view, the civil law overrode it, and the Islamic center was set up. And then sort of the code of that story is one of the Muslim families that was involved in the Islamic center was vacationing out on the lake, and one of their kids disappeared. And the neighbors, all Christian Reformed Christian, Dutch from Oostburg, not only did they lead the search party, they called the imam because they said, wait, if I had a situation like this, I would want my religious leader here. And so they roped them in. So it was a story, not to sort of, the happy ending doesn't diminish the idea that there was bigotry there. But the whole story is a way of showing how America, being a patchwork, allows for lots of little communities that have very distinctive natures to live side by side in peace and have overlapping layers that form these little platoons, that form solidarity, and that's really necessary. And once people start to lack that identity, that's when things start to fall apart. So you look in parts of the country where people don't have strong ethnic, religious, or local sense, and that's where you're seeing the worst outcomes.
Now, Tim, thanks a lot for that call, Mike. Suppose we're in a community that has fallen apart in some way and doesn't have that civil society. Can you put it back together? What would it take?
It's hard to put it back together from nothing. Every individual has to do work to build it up. Civil society doesn't keep going on its own. Community always takes the effort of people who are going to say, this is an important thing to do, and we're going to do it together. But sometimes, so one of the places I go in alienated America is Fayette County, Pennsylvania, south of Pittsburgh. And while Pittsburgh is doing pretty well, the rural places outside of it are not necessarily. And so there's a real question there that I get asked a lot. Should you try to rebuild a town where the public schools have no involvement from the parents, and you'd be the only involved parents, and the local diner has shut down, and the local church has shut down. Should I try to build that up, or should I get up and go? And it's a real difficult question, because the American story, there's sort of two American dreams. One is we all got on boats and came over here and then kept going west. But the other is, as Tocqueville writes, we all sort of settled down and planted roots and dedicated ourselves to where we were. So it is sort of a tricky question of how to balance that. But what I would say is, if you are going to get up and go, I think that what's needed to sort of build the good life for yourself and for other people is wherever you end up, you plant roots there. So sometimes in sort of a modern capitalistic economy, people think, well, I'm going to go where I need to go as long as it's profitable, as long as I'm getting something from it, and move on. People have this attitude towards business. People have this attitude towards where they live. People have this attitude towards relationships. That's destructive. You have to have relationships, not just transactions. You have to plant roots in places to be able to sort of extract the good life for yourself and help supply it for other people.
Even if there's not a blueprint to do that, are you optimistic that we can move in that direction?
I am, and Augsburg is one of the reasons why. This is a perfectly middle-class town, because in so many places in America, the only places where there are strong communities are among the elites, which is to say highly educated, wealthy people. But that's not the only places. You know, I see it in Salt Lake City. You see it in, if you want a secular example, you see it in a lot of New England towns where the local government, the local people really control a public school, and they're joined together in a joint pursuit of a higher purpose outside of themselves. That's the key. That's what I'm talking about when I talk about community and civil society. I think it is doable. It will take something of a great awakening in civic responsibility. It may take better, newer attitudes towards how we handle technology, how we build the physical shape of communities, not necessarily around cars, but around human beings. But I think it's definitely very doable. If America is good at anything, it's sort of restarting and taking on new challenges.
We'll leave it there, Tim. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Tim Carney with the Washington Examiner. His new book is Alienated America: Why Some Places Thrive While Others Collapse. Coming up, the State Department has cut aid to three Central American countries, with President Trump saying they haven't done enough to slow migration toward the United States. We'll talk about that and the president's threat to close the southern border. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent welcomes WPR's Sean Johnson for a look at the results from today's state Supreme Court election. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, President Trump is eliminating foreign assistance programs for three Central American countries, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, saying they aren't doing enough to stop people from leaving those countries and immigrating to the United States. The president is also threatening to shut down some or all of the southern border with Mexico, while the Department of Homeland Security deals with what it's calling a crisis level of immigrant families in custody and asylum claims to process. Fernando Pizarro joins us now. He's a Washington correspondent for Univision. Fernando, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks. Thanks for having me. I appreciate the invitation.
Now, the State Department's talking about eliminating aid for those three countries, El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, about $500 million at stake right now. Can you tell us what this money is usually meant for and how it's used?
This money is usually given to some private organization sometimes, and it is not very clear usually how it's distributed. The president confirmed today that he had gave the order yesterday to end this aid, which is not something he had not threatened to do before. This was not totally new when he mentioned it for the first time on Friday. He was touring Lake Okeechobee in Florida with the governor of Florida and some Florida lawmakers, including, for instance, Senator Marco Rubio, who is part of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate, who is probably not very happy with the tone that the Trump was taking with about this aid. This aid goes for organizations, for NGOs. Some of it goes to the government. It's mostly to fight crime. And as you know, the three countries you mentioned, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, are part of what is called the Northern Triangle in Central America. And the last few years have been very infamous for their high crime levels. And that's one of the reasons why this enormous flow has been coming basically since the Obama administration. Let's look back at the crisis of the unaccompanied minors, which happened right in the middle of the second term of the Obama administration and put them in the uncomfortable position of having to deport a lot of minors. And this has basically now transformed itself into a migration of families with kids.
I want to give a listen to White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney this week, echoing the president's concerns that some of the blame here falls on those countries in the Northern Triangle.
Mexico could help us do it. They need to do a little bit more. Honduras could do more. Nicaragua could do more. El Salvador could do more. And if we're going to give these countries hundreds of millions of dollars, we would like them to do more.
Is there a case to be made that those three countries could be doing more to prevent people from fleeing across their borders, ultimately going to the United States border?
They could be doing more. If I may have a little bit of a background here, the aid for this to these countries just in the last 10-15 years has it was called the Merida Initiative. Mexico wanted to get involved as well. So the U.S. was giving money to Mexico, and then during the Obama administration, Mexico took even a more active role in the sense, instead not just of receiving aid, but helping to give aid to Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. And it took another name under the Obama administration, but basically it was the same plan. The Obama administration also, when it was faced with the influx of unaccompanied minors, also tried to create different programs to increase development, to try to avoid the outflow of migrants, and also created a program for some of these kids, which was not very successful because it was very difficult to do, to ask for asylum while they were in their own country, something that did not really go very well because it was just a very difficult bureaucratic thing to get done and to get accomplished. And Trump ended that program. Now there's been talk about restarting it again. But these countries could be doing more. El Salvador seems to be better prepared. Actually, only recently, some of the Trump immigration DHS officials had been praising El Salvador for their work and for trying to diminish migration to the U.S. And now, let's not forget that only last week, right before Trump came with this threat, which is made good on yesterday, Secretary Nielsen was in Central America and signed what they called a historic agreement to try to limit the people leaving the country, trying to fight crime, mostly gangs. This has been the biggest concern for the Obama and the Trump administration. Let's not forget that the MS-13 and the 18th Street gangs, which are the ones that dominate mostly in El Salvador, are basically American exports. These gangs were originated in California in the 80s, and with the deportation of many of these people, they went back and they reformed in El Salvador, and now they're sending kids back with links to the gang, and they basically reestablished themselves in the U.S. But yes, they could be doing more, and that's basically what what the Trump administration wants them to do.
Talking to Fernando Pizarro from Univision, talking about some of the latest issues on the U.S. border. So far, we're focusing on aid cuts to three Central American countries. And now, Fernando, the president talking about shutting down all or part of the U.S.-Mexico border. What would that entail? What would go into a decision like that?
Well, today he said that he would do it 100%, but now he gave a condition. That's what he said this afternoon at the White House. He said that he wants a deal with Congress. So he's bringing back the idea that Congress should have to do something, which, as we know, last year that did not work for him when he tried to put out some options in order to get the DACA, this deal for Dreamers, and fixed in exchange for money for the wall. And the money for the wall has been the big obstacle for him in Congress, as we all know. But the Department of Homeland Security yesterday announced that they were going to be basically moving some of their assets, personnel to the border, CBP, Customs and Border Protection agents, which also includes the Border Patrol. They would be moving them to some of the ports of entry in preparation for what eventually could be a closing of the border. But apparently some of the advisors at the White House have been telling him as well that it may be disastrous economically. But today he said security was more important than trade. Now, what could this mean? Is it a total closure of the border, or is it some parts of the border? At this moment, we're not very clear, and the president said that he hasn't put a date on it. So we'll see. I mean, this is obvious. Even Republican Senate leader Mitch McConnell gave his opinion today, said it would be absolutely disastrous for the economy to close the border. So right now, it's still kind of a threat, but he could do it. He's not the first president that would close the border temporarily, but it's something that obviously cannot go on for a long time.
Talking to Fernando Pizarro, Washington correspondent for Univision, looking at some of the latest developments on the immigration front, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the president is right to cut aid to Central American countries, saying they're not doing enough to stop people from leaving those countries and heading here to the United States, or do you think that could be counterproductive? What do you think of the idea of shutting down completely all or part of the U.S.-Mexico border? What should the U.S. be thinking about as a long-term solution for the immigration system? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Fernando Pizarro of Univision, looking at President Trump's threat to close the southern border and the decision to cut aid to El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think that cutting aid to those countries would be an effective way to get them to try to slow migration to the United States? Or do you worry it could be counterproductive? What do you think of the idea of closing all or part of the border between Mexico and the United States? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Tom is with us in Port Wing. Tom, hi.
Hi. Hey, I have a question as far as we have spent millions of dollars enforcing the border between Guatemala and Mexico, which is where, you know, these Central Americans are passing through. How much of that $500 million went towards enforcing the Guatemala-Mexico border, where Mosquito Indians were the real subject for the Mexican government to keep out of Mexico?
Tom, thanks for the call. Fernando, is that this money we're talking about, or is that a different money, security at that border?
Well, I unfortunately cannot answer the question specifically. It's a very good question from your listener about the specific amount and how much of those $500 million. Let's remember that some of the money that was spent from the Merida Initiative back from the Bush administration and then on to the Obama administration were among those lines about every year or so. So some of that money went to Mexico as well, that it would improve their you know, security or border enforcement in the southern border. But let me give you another figure, if I may. The Migration Policy Institute here in Washington released this information today that Mexico has deported more Central American migrants than the United States did, for instance, in fiscal year 2015, 2016, and 2017. So basically, that Mexico has accounted for 55% of the 1.2 million deportations of Central American migrants carried out by the U.S. and Mexico combined. So they have been trying to do this, but for Mexico also, it is a difficult situation. They've been trying to give all these humanitarian visas that were announced by President Andrés Manuel López Obrador. He just took over in December, so it's a fairly new administration. Now, the tone and the rhetoric by President Trump has changed dramatically with Mexico, because we all remember how his campaign began and the tone that he had with the former president of Mexico, Enrique Peña Nieto, was pretty antagonistic throughout his first basically 2 years. But with the new Mexican administration, he had a very good relationship so far. He had toned down his rhetoric, and let's not forget that also in the middle of that was the renegotiation of NAFTA, which is still has to be, you know, ratified by the U.S. Congress, the new United States, Mexico, and Canada agreement. And all this rhetoric was also toned down by the White House when all this basically the three countries signed this new agreement. So now Trump has basically has begun to attack Mexico one more time, like he used to with the previous president. So now Andrés Manuel López Obrador has had a very careful relationship with the White House, and he's tried not to antagonize Trump. The only thing that the Mexican government has said so far is that they do not respond well to threats. But right now, we don't have the same level of antagonism that the White House and the former Mexican president had in previous months.
Let's go to another caller now. Donna is with us in Menominee Falls. Donna, hi.
Hi. Well, my comment or my question is, we have a common problem here. The United States has these people immigrating in, and it's tough on us. But they also, you know, these countries also are losing decent people, and they're going to be left with all these drug lords and everything. Why don't we sit down and talk about our common problem and what we can do to solve it together?
Donna, thanks for the call. So have we tried this kind of international summit, U.S., Mexico, the three Central American countries we've been talking about?
There have been talks. There were talks even during the Obama administration, when the first crisis of unaccompanied minors hit in mid 2014. So there have been talks and try to solve this issue. Now, the Trump administration, as we all know, has taken a harder position on this. Basically, as we all know, the rhetoric on immigration that the president has. So I think there is a bigger issue here at stake, which is what to do with these migrants that are leaving these three countries in droves. The situation there has become desperate for many. I do think that there is a certain agreement in Congress and perhaps in public opinion in the U.S. that there is a crisis, whether it's a national emergency or not, that would be a political issue. But there is a crisis of these people that keep on coming to the U.S. and are using the tactic now of asking for asylum to be let into the U.S. The Trump administration's argument is that more than 80% of these asylum claims end up not being true. That's kind of hard to believe. So many people come here because of fear of being killed, of being exploited by gangs, and basically because of insecurity in these three countries. But something should be done, and at this moment there have been talks, as I said before, but nothing has really seemed to have been working at this level.
Thanks a lot for that call, Donna. And Fernando, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
That's Fernando Pizarro, Washington correspondent for Univision. He was with us to talk about the State Department's decision to cut aid to El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, and the president's renewed threats to close the U.S. border with Mexico. There's still time to share your thoughts on these issues. Tell us what you think. Email ideas at WPR.org, or as always, you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. When the administration at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, announced a plan to cut more than a dozen majors last year, hundreds of students responded by protesting. In November, the chancellor announced a revised plan, but six majors are still being considered for elimination. As Bridget Bowden reports, UW Stevens Point is grappling with budget shortfalls, changing demographics, and how regional public universities will adapt to a new reality.
UW-Stevens Point freshman Litzy Baltierrez is in the student union selling chocolate bars to raise money for the Latino Student Alliance. She's studying social work, which isn't one of the majors being considered for elimination. But even still, she's worried.
If they start removing a lot of majors, I don't know if my major will be in that elimination process. And if it is, then it's time for me to look to go back home or go to a different school, which I'm starting to look into it just in case.
She's concerned that the university might not be able to meet students' needs if it cuts majors.
I understand like we're in our financial struggle, but many students do come here just because it's a like cheaper college, a small campus, and there's still programs that are being offered.
But university administrators say UWSP can't continue to be all things to all people. The university is facing major budget shortfalls, and it's only expected to get worse in the coming years. The chancellor's plan says UWSP must become a, quote, new kind of regional university. It includes potentially eliminating lower enrollment majors in French, German, geography, geoscience, 2D and 3D art, and history. Critics say it devalues the liberal arts, but Chancellor Bernie Patterson insists they're not going away.
We're going to continue all the disciplines in the liberal arts. None of that is going away. Whether we have a major in each one of them is yet to be determined.
The plan would create two centers in the university that Patterson says would help infuse all majors with the liberal arts and do outreach to local high schools. The new model would be more career-focused and would rely on partnering with local businesses to produce graduates ready to go to work in local industries. In Patterson's view, restructuring the university is no different than what a business would do in tough financial times.
They stop delivering some products and develop new products. They restructure, they downsize, they expand, they diversify. This is how businesses operate.
Tom Harnish of the American Association of State Colleges and Universities says what's happening at Stevens Point is happening all over the country, and there are several reasons why.
Countless millions in budget cuts handed down from state lawmakers, mandatory tuition increase caps and tuition freezes, as well as demographic shifts have forced these institutions to make difficult choices.
Like many public regional universities, UW-Stevens Point added majors and grew along with the baby boom generation. But now the number of high school grads is in decline. And Harnish says public regional universities like Stevens Point are at a disadvantage because they don't have the wealth and reach for out-of-state students of large flagship universities. Provost Greg Summers says economic anxiety is influencing what students choose to study.
The recession caused students who were already concerned about the level of debt that they were taking on with higher education to become very concerned with the return on the investment that they're going to get from their tuition dollars.
English professor Mary Bowman says the last year has been emotional for faculty, especially those who teach in the liberal arts. But she says there is a silver lining.
That has kind of sparked a conversation about what is the value of a degree in the humanities, and what kinds of jobs do people who major in history or English or French or geography go on to do?
Chancellor Patterson hopes to have a final plan by the end of the semester. When he does, the Board of Regents may get a chance to weigh in on the new direction for UWSP. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll check out the results from today's state Supreme Court election and what it all means for the future. And if you can't wait that long, you can follow the results tonight over at wisconsinvote.org. And you can still, if you haven't voted yet and want to check out the candidates for Supreme Court, find some interviews with those candidates at wisconsinvote.org. Also tomorrow, a national security whistleblower says the Trump administration intervened to approve 24 security clearances that had been rejected. We'll find out more in our weekly review of national politics. And turning off your lights can save lives. That's the message from a Wisconsin environmental researcher who says energy conservation can have big public health benefits. That and more all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, Governor Tony Evers joins the show to talk about the latest on his budget plans, conflicts with the state legislature, and other issues facing Wisconsin. It's tomorrow at 7:30 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, from setting goals to giving feedback, there are a lot of assumptions about how to make the workplace the best it can be. Our guest says a lot of those assumptions are wrong. They're lies. We'll find out why with the co-author of the book, 9 Lies About Work. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.